The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The Senate now passed that new $484 billion relief package that will support small businesses, hospitals, and more coronavirus testing.
As some states get back to business, it's anything but usual. Tennessee and South Carolina loosening restrictions, but the most aggressive rollout is in neighboring Georgia. Starting Friday, all hair salons, barber shops, tattoo parlors, even bowling alleys are clear to reopen. The governor says safety measures must remain in place, including 6-foot social distancing and wearing masks.
This, as we see U.S. cases, as you mentioned, slowing down nationwide, rising just around 3%. To give you some context, that's just below the average over the past week or so. Total cases still amount to 835,000 in the country. New York, the epicenter, saw the fewest deaths in a day since early April, and the governor, Andrew Cuomo, there saying downstate New York now on the descent of the curve. He's now working with neighboring states like Connecticut and New Jersey to build a tracing army to track the virus's spread, and California also coming up with a similar strategy.
I mean, listen, it's funny, we're talking about the price of oil soaring, but the price of oil is still under 20 bucks a barrel. I mean, these times are pretty insane. You know, and they are hitting the U.S. fracking industry, and really they're going to start to hit the job market as well. On a day with the unemployment number coming in the way it did, I don't think we could look at any other side of the story.
The latest unemployment numbers are pretty stark. New applications for unemployment benefits mean the total number of people who have lost their jobs since mid-March is now 26.4 million. That is around 15% of the U.S. workforce.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Death toll from COVID-19 surpasses 50,000. The president signs a $484 billion stimulus bill, and 4.4 million workers file for unemployment claims, bringing the total now to exceed 26 million. Oil crashes below zero this week, falling by 300% in a single day, with major indexes losing ground after a torrid two-week rally. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. John Kosar from Asbury Research will join me this week. His favorite market indicators, there's six of them, are all flashing positive as tech continues to dominate the market. John thinks gold will take out its old highs. And on the subject of gold, Dr. Keith Barron, founder and CEO of Urania Resources, he'll be joining me as we look at gold prices. What is driving gold higher? And the gold producers are flying high because of three key factors. Later on in the program on The Big Picture, Chris Sheridan and I will look at the economic comeback. What is it going to look like? The road back to recovery, oil, and the economy. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. A rather rare and odd occurrence fell upon oil this week, and it needs to be mentioned. Now, due to demand destruction, storage capacity of oil has filled to the brim. And because there's nowhere to put store oil, speculators were more than willing, and maybe USO, the ETF, was partly to blame. I'm not sure exactly, but speculators were more than willing to take a financial loss than take actual delivery, dumping their May contracts of oil on Monday. And that caused oil contracts to plummet such that a barrel of West Texas Intermediate oil closed at down negative $37.63 for May delivery. Now, traders were paying for others to take delivery. So the USO ETF, sponsored by the United States Commodity Funds, took drastic measures as a result. They've decided to diversify the contracts it holds to future months instead of just mainly in the near-term contract, and now holds around 40% in June contracts, 55% in July contracts, and 5% in August contracts. So obviously, they rolled over quite a few contracts there. Previously, the objective of the fund was to track spot, but not anymore. They've also stopped issuing shares of the ETF, making it trade more like a closed-end fund for now. The losses in oil and the negative contract influenced selling pressure on Monday and Tuesday as well, but I also think that stocks are running up into resistance over valuations. As I mentioned last week, you know, we talked about earnings are, were only estimated down 12%, and the S&P was trading at 18 times earnings. So they could be running into a little bit of that. Oil snapped back on Wednesday, lending to a rally in stocks with renewed leadership from the mega cap stocks like Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, basically your FANG mega caps. This came after the S&P 500 had declined around 4.8% over previous sessions and was at the time considered oversold. That afternoon on, I believe, Wednesday, the Senate passed a $484 billion COVID-19 relief bill, with most of it, around $310 billion, helping to fund the Paycheck Protection Program, which had actually run out of funds as of last week. When we first learned about, you know, the program was tapped out, that was around Wednesday when the Small Business Administration said that more than 1.3 million loans were approved, but that the value of the, that loan was right around $296 billion for those approved. Obviously, that had spent down pretty much largely most of the funds that were available. We didn't see a huge response to the news in the stock market when the relief bill was passed, but I'm sure small businesses probably appreciate the relief for those that can get it, as demand is incredibly high for these loans. Because if you hold a certain amount of employees over the period of, I think, June 30th, this loan largely becomes a grant and forgivable. And the bill was, in fact, signed in on Friday by Trump. Now, going back to valuations and resistance in the market, you know, let's talk about that, as around 24% of the S&P 500 companies have reported as of Friday. So blended estimate earnings for the first quarter, including those that have reported thus far, is down 15.8% for the first quarter. As analysts believe we'll have negative quarters up ahead, the forward price to earnings multiple on the S&P 500 is around 19.1 times earnings. And, you know, recently Oaktree's co-chairman Howard Marks on an interview had said basically, with the market only down 15% at one point this week, he said the world is more than 15% screwed up. So yeah, again, valuations are a concern. But interestingly, the S&P 500 appeared to be having a difficulty moving above its 50-day moving average, but it did so on Friday with some of the mega caps doing much of the heavy lifting. The economic figures continue to be bad, so no real news there. And I won't belabor some of this as it's not really moving the market, but just to, you know, we can talk about these numbers because we'll want to talk about when they're improving and to see how the market either lifts or reacts to that kind of news. So durable goods declined 14.4% in March. Consumer sentiment was down 71.8% in April versus 89 in March. Initial unemployment claims didn't go up as much as it did in previous weeks. So we've been seeing that decelerate, but it was still up around 4.4 million. New home sales dropped 15.4% in March. So obviously very bad economic news this week, in some cases better than last week. And that's what I think a lot of traders are mainly looking for. Where's the hope and where's the possibility of the V-like recovery in the economy? One last news item. You know, we talked about Gilead's remdesivir drug last week showing positive results during a study at the University of Chicago last week. A leaked study this week, however, refuted those claims. And the World Health Organization posted the study on Thursday, but immediately took it down. Obviously, some concerns and complaints by Gilead about the subjectivity of the report, because largely they were doing treatments with a very small pool of patients. And these patients were very severe cases of COVID-19, where Gilead's spokesperson basically said that there's been some meaningful improvements for patients that have been given the treatment much earlier. So they said, you know, it's not very conclusive. The WHO organization pulled it from their site. So the story was attributed actually with dropping the S&P 500 by a percentage point on Thursday. That's it for the week. And the major story was oil, crazy volatility there, all regarding, you know, there's not enough. Actually, there's no more stores. There's no more space. Storage is filled to the brim with oil. Can't take delivery. So what do you do with your financial contract? Well, stick it in the backyard, I guess. Stocks will continue to be prone to any COVID-19 news of a therapy or vaccine news. So we'll obviously continue to focus on any kind of stories there, and seems largely able to shrug off the economic news. And the earnings, like I said, have been bad. And that too, the S&P is largely able to shrug off. And that's largely due to the success, I would say, of how aggressively the Fed has accommodated and how aggressively all of Congress has been behind the fiscal stimulus and able to vote through in addition to the Paycheck Protection Program this week. That's it for me.
Bruce Mellon says that COVID is the new climate change and talks about the great reopening debate that is currently taking place around the nation. Based on his most recent quarterly presentation titled After COVID, Politics and Policy in the Age of Pandemic. Here's what he had to say on how America is going to be reopening in the weeks and months ahead.
The operational reality to half-speed economy. It's not normal amount of investment, not normal amount of consumption. You're going to need temperature checks a lot of the places. A lot of people are going to be wearing masks. You're going to have rolling regional flare-ups and lockdowns. They're going to have to redesign some public spaces. And for a lot of businesses, you got to worry whether it's liability. That's not the economy that we've been used to. And so that will be slower growth, and that will be new challenges. That's the operational reality, and it's why growth can't be back to the way it was for at least a year or so. The flip side of that, though, is the politics. And for the politics, COVID's the new climate change. It is ground zero for 2020 culture wars. In a lot of ways, it's the same line. People who believe that scientists are always the answer and right versus those who are wary of what they would consider elite consensus, when they would say that elite consensus often has gotten things wrong.
As always, if you'd like to hear this full interview with Bruce Mellon, in addition to our three other interviews airing each week on FS Insider through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow at financialsense.com.
At least the good news is asset prices have been rising. But how much further will they go? Will we hit new highs, or are we due for a consolidation here shortly? Joining me on the program from Asbury Research is John Kozar. John, I want to begin our discussion with two different sides of what's going on in the market. You've got this V-shaped recovery that we're seeing in stocks since we hit a bottom, and then we're talking about maybe a U-shaped recovery if the economy comes online. You and I were talking before we went on the air, is if they bring the economy back, are people going to jump on airplanes, start going out on a regular basis, and start going to movies or gyms? And so I wonder if we might talk about that, because it seems like there's a dichotomy between the two.
There totally is. And there usually is. We just see this one more because it's such an extreme situation with COVID. You don't get paid in the stock market by trading the economy, because although, I mean, they're ultimately the same thing, they run on different speeds. The economy is day to day. There's new information coming out. There's new talk with governors opening, talking about opening. And then there's the stock market, which is a discounting mechanism that, depending on who you talk to, it discounts the economy 1 to 3 quarters ahead or more, than that. So they're two different, they're related, but they're really two different animals. And we don't get paid on what the economy does. We get paid on what the stock market does. So for us, our shop, what we do, nothing has really changed. We're just following the money. We're following the data, and we're trying not to outsmart ourselves. I mean, keeping it simple in that way. During these times, a quantitative approach, a data-driven approach, really has its advantages, because you can kind of move away from the din of information that's in your face every day, and you could just look at the numbers, and that's what we do.
And let's speak of those numbers, because we had a lot of money coming out of the bond funds. We had a lot of money recently going into energy funds like the USO ETF. And then we have a lot of money going to gold. So as you look at these money flows, John, what are they telling you? Where's the money going?
Gold has been one that we've been watching. Frankly, we've had our hands full just trying to keep up with the stock market. There's just been, everything's been faster. Everything's, been kind of turned up a couple of notches in terms of speed. What I have been watching is GLD, gold, and I'm actually getting over there now so I can speak to the chart. Gold does not follow futures. It follows gold bullion, as your listeners probably know. But what I noticed was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I started seeing assets trending back into GLD. You know, we look at the total net assets. We track total net assets in about 100, 150 ETFs. You know, that range from gold to interest rates to stock indexes and so on and so forth. But about a few weeks ago, I noticed the flows started to turn positive again in GLD. We had broken a really big overhead resistance level. We first did it back in looking at the chart back in February, and then we came back down to the 200-day moving average in March, and now we're moving higher. It's trading at 162.57 right now. We've got a target on gold of 174. And now that we've cleared this major resistance level around 147 or 148, as long as those asset flows keep coming into gold, I think we're going to see that 174 number sooner rather than later. I mean, I think we could see it in the next month or two.
Wow. And if we break out and you hit those kind of levels, does it just, you know, you see a pullback, you see consolidation, or is that the sign that you could actually even go higher? In other words, a breakout to levels like we saw, I'm trying to think of going back to 2011.
Yeah, what usually happens is the market's a lot more sophisticated now than it was 20 years ago because of people's access to more information over the internet. Most places that you would invest in, you know, big shops, small shops, everybody has access to some kind of charting software. Some, even though it might be simplistic, people understand those levels more. And I think it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy to a degree in terms of, in some senses, I think technical analysis, basic technical analysis tools, support and resistance targets work better now because there's more people looking at them. There's more people that understand them. It's more of an accepted way to manage your portfolio than it was 30 years ago. So where I'm going with that is I'm not the only guy on earth that knows how to read charts. I think if we get up to that 174 area, what I've noticed is once I get close to a target that I've measured, you know, by looking at a chart, I really start to watch those flows because those flows will tell you if there are people taking profits up there. So that's what I would be doing. If we get up into the low 170s, now I'm looking at those flows every day to see if they start to deteriorate, which would mean there's people taking profits, people ringing the cash register up there. At that point, you know, you may elect to do the same, wait for a good break to buy, and then watch for those flows to come back into the market. That's how we do it here. I think it makes sense. It's data driven. And if this economy is going to be as slow to come back as many of us, including myself, think is going to be the case, it makes sense to me that this trend in gold isn't going to go away. There's still going to be people that are looking for alternative investments to the stock market.
Let's talk about another sector of the market, and I want to talk about technology, and especially you know, the FANG stocks, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Googles. They seem to be holding up and driving a lot of what was happening in the market. And I was reading, John, if you back out, you know, the FANG stocks out of the S&P, it doesn't look as good.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good place to go in terms of the interview here. What I do is, I'm sure what a lot of people do, after the market suffers a big hit like we have, you're looking at the large capitalization, typically tech stocks, because they tend to lead. They tend to lead up and down. So you want to see how they're performing outright. You want to see how they're outperforming relative to the S&P 500. And I just pulled up a chart here of Microsoft, because that has been one, along with Intel, that's been one of my poster children that I've been watching here. Microsoft, price activity in Microsoft over the past 3 weeks has been really constructive. I actually have a chart pattern here that targets a move to 198, which would mean a new all-time high. It doesn't mean, just because there's a price target, it doesn't mean we have to hit it. But when you're looking at the stock market, especially after it's taken a big hit like this, and you're looking for, you know, you're turning over rocks to try to see some indication of where the market's leaning. It's leaning higher. I've actually got a relative performance chart here of Microsoft versus the S&P 500. And it first started outperforming the S&P in a 21. This actually goes even back further. It started outperforming back around Thanksgiving. It started outperforming the S&P 500 on a monthly basis. It keeps doing that. So I'm looking at Intel. I've got a price target in Intel. There's other ones. So yeah, the tip of the spear, as I like to call it, looks healthy, targets higher prices. I'm looking at I've got a target of 68.50 in Intel. We're at 59.78 right now. So I don't understand it. I see the same things you do. You know, businesses are closed. I wonder how they're going to reopen. How do you open up a restaurant when you can only have half the amount of tables there? You know, there's all of this stuff crosses my mind. But again, I'm not getting paid to try to handicap, you know, the restaurant business or the airline business. I am getting paid to try to follow the money in the stock market. And right now, while we're talking, our models turn back to positive. We have two tactical models. They turn back to positive, one on April 7th, one on April 9th. And I've got some targets in some of these bellwether tech stocks that suggest that we're going to take a run at the old highs. It doesn't make sense to me. But again, I'm just following the data.
And let's talk about your Asbury 6. This is a key group of indicators that you use. What is the Asbury 6 telling you right now?
The Asbury 6, I'm actually getting over there as we speak. The Asbury 6 are six separate indicators that we basically back-tested would have been my favorite indicators after being in the business for 40 years this year, quantitatively tested them to say, how do we take these indicators, throw the ones out that are just redundant to others and keep those that are a little bit different, where all six of those will give you kind of a six-sided look at the stock market and will work well offsetting false signals or incorrect signals in some of the six. And we came up with these six, and they have been positive since April 7th. Actually, if you go to our website, there's a sample there under models, and you could take a look at those. But they went to positive on April 7th. All six are currently positive. Of the six, only one of them is based on price alone. It's the monthly rate of change in the S&P 500. The other five are not based on price because with algorithmic trading being whatever it is, 75-80% of the daily volume in the stock market, there's a lot of choppy false moves on a day-to-day basis that you see in the S&P 500. And other indexes. People who trade these things every day know that. They seem to run the stops up and down, and sometimes just focusing on price isn't enough. So we, five of the six are stuff like flows into the spider, high yield corporate bond spreads, unbalanced volume, other stuff like that. So we're obviously, we get paid on price on what the S&P 500 does, but I'm focusing more on under the hood indications of the day-to-day condition of the market and not so much on the tick-by-tick movement in the S&P 500 anymore, frankly.
Another question, as you've been speaking here, have you ever seen movements this quick and this often in the market in your career?
Boy, that's a good question. I was on the trading floor in the S&P 500 pit during the crash in 1987, and I could still see images in my head of what that looked like. And if you're on the floor, everything's amplified, right? Because every, you know, there's thousands of people there jumping, crying, laughing, pushing, shoving. It's like a John Wayne movie on steroids that day. But I don't recall. I think that this was nastier, faster. Again, you know, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, the trading floor was the most just because I was there. If you're physically there, it seems like it's, you know, bigger and better and badder than it was. But I think this move down was the quickest. Let's put it this way. I try to judge everything quantitatively. Going into that weekend, February 21st was a Friday. I think four or five of our Asbury 6 were positive. By the close on Monday, all six were negative. Mm-hmm. And I never saw those metrics turn all at the same time that fast. We're looking at corporate bond spreads and relative performance charts, all these diverse measurements of the market that I put together so I wouldn't have them all turn at the same time. You know, they're all a little bit different. They all turned on a dime that Monday, which was the 24th. And then if you recall, the market opened on Tuesday, relatively unchanged from Monday's close. And then that was it. It was straight down, you know, within what, just a few weeks, we got down to the late March lows.
You know, the thing that strikes me, John, and it's really hard to believe, And I think what we've just gone through is going to be one of those seminal events that is going to change a lot of things. You know, we're talking about when we come out of this, what's it going to be like for people getting on airplanes? What's it going to be like going to a restaurant, a gym, a movie theater? A lot of that is going to change. And the thing that really strikes me about this, it's hard to believe, 2 months ago, the markets were at record levels. The unemployment was the lowest we've seen in six decades. Global economies were picking up and growing. And here we are 2 months later, we're talking about double-digit unemployment. Unemployment claims now, I think, are 22 million or more. And they're talking about one of the biggest contractions in the shortest period of time that we've seen in history.
Yeah, these are times. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this because if you want apples to apples comparison, you know, we had a pandemic in 1918. There's a PBS special. I'm a big fan of PBS, and there's an American Experience special that talks about that. I watched it twice. I found it on the internet and watched it twice just to try to understand how it was then and how people reacted. Obviously, it was a completely different economy. It was 100 years ago. There was no internet. It was still an industrial society, a farming society back then. And then I realized trying to measure, I should just be looking at fear, greed. I should, because that's something that no matter what the event is, you know, whether it's, you know, the financial crisis or the 87 crash or the tech bubble going across, the fear should stay constant. So I looked at a lot of indicators like, you know, the percentage that the S&P is trading below the 200-day moving average, breadth statistics, volatility. And there's about a half a dozen of these, and they're all at levels, if you go back 30 years, that have all coincided with major bottoms. Sometimes there was a secondary bottom. If you go back to 07, when all these extremes hit, that first bottom was November 2008. That's when you saw the big spike in the VIX and percentage of S&P percentage underneath its 200-day moving average, all those things I just mentioned. And then you didn't get the final bottom until March of 09. So we could very well have another retest or make a new low in here and maybe not have a bottom until Labor Day or Thanksgiving. I don't know. I'm not a fortune teller, but I try to measure fear rather than try to handicap COVID, which is impossible. I mean, I don't think anybody can do that.
Yeah. I mean, we have no idea, even if they open up the economy. You know, I imagine if you've been staying in your house for 6 weeks or 2 months, you probably might want to go out and do a few things. But I think people's behavior is going to change. And still, John, we don't even know if it comes back again when flu season starts up at the end of September. What do we do then?
So, yeah. No, that's right. And you know, the other thing I was thinking too is, you know, the one thing that really amazes me is the durability of, you know, the economy and of, you know, ingenuity. It's going to be different. It's going to change things. But while some businesses are going to never come back or come back in a different way, other businesses are going to thrive. Look at Netflix. I mean, that's just the one that comes to mind. But when this is over, there are going to be smart people in American business that are going to see the world has changed, and they're going to be able to get out in front of it, and they're going to figure out ways to make this work in their favor, and life will go on and our world will change and it'll be different. But, you know, I have a lot of confidence in, you know, the ability of people, companies in being able to adapt. And I think that's going to be the interesting part going forward.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, you're seeing it with Netflix. Take a look at Amazon. Even take a look at the big box stores like Walmart, Target, Costco, that have developed a sophisticated online presence. I mean, I'm even looking at Best Buy. I needed to order something, and they meet you out front with your orders. So you don't even have to go in the store. You order it online and pick it up.
Yes, that's what I was talking about. People still have money to spend. People still have to eat. People still want to be entertained. All of the needs are there. It's just how we satisfy those needs is going to change. And the smartest and the fastest are going to win, and our world will go on, and it will change. You know, it's going to certainly make picking stocks and picking companies to invest in a lot more. I mean, we're a data-driven shop, and we're watching money flows. But I mean, there's going to be a lot of really smart people out there that are going to be able to get ahead of this by 2 years, and that's going to be your next big business. Maybe it's going to be your next Apple. I mean, not, you know, necessarily in that business, but the next several businesses that are going to really be the, you know, the leaders. You know, the 800-pound gorillas might be those that are smart enough to look ahead and forecast how our society is going to change.
Listen, John, as we conclude here, I'm picking up a couple things. Your Asbury 6 are all on positive mode. The tip of the spear, the techs are leading, and you expect them to go higher. And you also expect gold to go higher. So as an investor, is that where you would focus your attention?
I think so. But I think you've got to be really nimble here. I don't think, certainly set it and forget it is going to be very difficult here. I think the risk is you say, okay, I think there's a bottom in place. So you buy the market. And then we go back and revisit those lows, or maybe we take them out by another 5 or 10%. And then we get our bottom in September. And then 6 months later, you know, the country has adapted. American businesses are starting to adapt, and you know, the market can see that. So you just really have to be careful to get your timing right. I don't know that you go all in here. I think, you know, you separate your money into buckets. You know, maybe you participate here and then you keep some dry powder in case we do drop another 10 or 15% and you can put more money to work. Or ideally, if we rally 15% more, then now you can average up. But I just think you got to be really careful about having a good long-term idea and poor near-term timing.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if listeners would like to find out more about the work you do at Asbury, how could they do so?
The best way, I think, is we have a bi-weekly market update, you know, that we put out. It's free of charge, and this is kind of how we introduce people to what we do. You sign up for that by going to asburyresearch.com, asbury research.com, and you can either go to the contact tab and ask to be put on the, you know, the free list, or on the landing page. You can actually, if you scroll down a little bit, there's an orange button there and you can sign up. It comes out every 2 weeks and you can have a look, see what we do, and it won't cost you anything, and we'll see what happens from there.
All right. Well, listen, John, stay safe and come back and talk again.
Great to talk to you, Jim. See you next time.
Stratfor's Michael Maunderer, who used to work at the U.S. Treasury, spoke with us on FS Insider this week about the sheer difficulty of making forecasts, given the unprecedented nature of what we're facing. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week.
The U.S. and the global economy are probably in the worst crisis, at least since the end of World War II, if not since the Great Depression. The economic forecasting, quite frankly, can't keep up with the speed of the spread of the virus, and most forecasts at this point are that the global economy is probably going to decline by anywhere between 2 and 4% this year. I need to caveat that because we really don't have any statistical basis on which we can do forecasting. We're in a situation of pure uncertainty and one in which we can't assign probabilities to outcomes to measure risk.
As always, if you'd like to listen to this full interview with Michael Maunderer at Stratfor to hear their assessment of the current environment, economically, geopolitically, and otherwise, in addition to our three other interviews airing every week, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, if you're an investor in 2020, there's been very few areas that you have not lost money and very few that you have made money. Two of those areas have been U.S. Treasuries and the price of gold. Let's take a look at where gold is heading in the future. Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He's chairman and CEO of Urania Resources, a gold and copper exploration company. Keith, let's talk about gold. Gold has done well this year, which is surprising given the fact that two of the biggest markets for gold are countries that have been quarantined as a result of the coronavirus. And I'm thinking of India and China. So what is driving gold other than the fact that it does well as a safety or a hedge or an asset you want to hold when there's widespread?
Well, Jim, hi, and thanks for having me on the program. I'm delighted to talk about my favorite subject. And initially, as a result of this pandemic, both gold and silver went down. And they went down because they functioned exactly the way they're supposed to, being extremely liquid. And people who had done margin trading, sold their bullion to cover margin calls. So we saw a lot of gold and silver coming onto the market. And the price dropped quite precipitously, and then it rebounded. And it rebounded very, very positively, and I think is continuing an upward trend. Now, both India and China, of course, the pandemic originated in China, and now it's starting to pick up steam in India, very, very unfortunately. Of course, they are very big consumers, but where does the buying come from? Well, it's coming internationally. Especially out of North America and Europe, as people run to it as a safe haven and a haven against currencies. The gold price right now is at an all-time high in pretty much every currency except for the U.S. dollar. And it's getting up there. You know, it's only really a shade under 17. And it'll be back up there again, I think, in fairly short order. You know, this is exactly the way precious metals should be behaving. People are just simply afraid of the equity markets. They're afraid of the bond markets. They're afraid of holding currencies. And so gold is something that isn't beholden to governments. It can't be inflated. And so this is where people are going to for safety.
Keith, let's talk about this environment. Gold does not pay interest or it doesn't pay dividends. So we're living in a world of negative interest rates and zero interest rates as we have here in the U.S. I mean, we thought things were bad during the financial crisis between 2007 and 2009, but rates have gone even lower this time around. But more importantly, in addition to negative or zero interest rates, governments are just blowing their budgets sky high. I think the deficit this year for the U.S. is going to be in the neighborhood of $3.5 trillion. I think we're not done yet. The other thing is once people get used to receiving subsidies, it's very hard for politicians to turn around. So in the next couple of years, the U.S. could be looking at $30 trillion in debt, and it's not just the U.S., it's global. You're seeing huge debt imbalances, more so, I think, in Europe, where you have some problems and you have negative interest rates. And then you also go to places like Japan. So isn't this more favorable for gold because it doesn't have to compete with high interest rates and the long-term impact will be inflationary?
Yes, well, I really think that in terms of the fact that gold doesn't give you a yield doesn't really matter anymore because the trend is upward and you can go on the internet and find, I would say, probably hundreds of commentators who are thinking the same way as I am. Now, you know, the American stock market had an all-time high in terms of the Dow just really before the first COVID case was reported in the U.S. I thought that actually the market was headed for a crash last October, really after it was revealed in September that there was trouble in the repo markets. And then, you know, just at the very beginning of March, the U.S. government put $50 billion into the repo market to prop it up. I really think you could have pushed, a three-year-old could have pushed this market over. It was looking for a signal, and it got the signal in spades, of course. And this is much, much more profound and deeper and sorrowful because people are losing their lives, much deeper than the 2008-2009 banking crisis. So I think you're exactly right. You know, what was done, you know, in America to get out of the 2008 and 2009 crisis, we had QE1 and we had QE2 and then we had Operation Twist. And that money, which was supposed to get the economy going and the U.S. Fed had targets for inflation, really didn't do much of anything. And the reason being was that it was being held by the banks and the banks needed to capitalize. And so the money was not going into the broad economy and the velocity of money, which is one way to really explain what inflation is. The velocity of money was very, very low. So we didn't have the inflation effect that we expected. So now we're in a situation where if something very, very drastically is not done and done quickly to get money into the hands of everybody, then we're going to go into a massive, massive deflation, maybe even a dirty 30 style depression. I think what's going to happen, this is my opinion, I think that they're going to do the much heralded helicopter drop of money. There's been talk about debt jubilees. And I think we're going to see a situation where the economy, the broad economy, is simply flooded with liquidity, and that is going to have profound implications for inflation going forward. I don't think the governments of the world are really bothered with what happens in a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. They've got to get out of this mess today. And so the way to do it is to put a certain sum of money into everybody's hands and get them to spend that money to jumpstart the economy.
You know, it's rather interesting because they're working on another package to supplement the loans to business. And you've got governors like Cuomo in New York that is saying, wait a minute, if you're going to bail out the airlines to the tune of $30 billion, why not the states? So it looks like, Keith, the states are going to be on the bailout handout next, because it would be pretty hard to deny states money when you're given airlines money. And that's kind of the next phase of this. So they're with MMT, or modern monetary theory, there's no endless restriction on the giving out of money, because you can basically just print as much as you want. And it seems like that's the direction, because I don't see any discipline in either party, nor do you hear any deficit hawks. If they are, they've been silenced, or basically they've disappeared.
That's right. Yeah, no, they've got to do something drastic to get out of this mess. So, you know, it's going to be debt forgiveness. It's going to be bailout of the airlines, but it's actually going to be bailout of everybody, Jim. It's going to be bailout of small business, of corporations. Muni bonds are going to be in trouble. They're going to bail municipalities out. They're going to bail pension funds out, because things like CalPERS are not going to be able to earn their 7% and pay their retirees their pensions. And the list goes on and on and on. This is unprecedented. We never have seen anything like this in recorded history. And it's basically do whatever you can. It'll be kind of like the Weimar Republic, spending money willy-nilly to make sure that the populace doesn't embrace Bolshevism. Germany almost at one point after the First World War became a vassal state of Russia. There were incredible amounts of money that were spent. And we all know the story, what happened with the Weimar. They went to in the hyperinflation. Eventually, the mark had to have 12 zeros lopped off the end. And they adopted a new currency called the Rentenmark. I think in our case, potentially we're going to go back to a modified gold standard, silver standard, something like that. But there's a lot of territory to recover to cover before that. I myself think, and I'm just an armchair economist. I'm not an expert by any means. But I'm living in Europe. I live in Switzerland, where I'm speaking to you now. And I really think you're going to see a bond default from Italy and from Spain. They've tried to get the rest of Europe to pay for Corona bonds, and the Germans and the Finns are not buying it. They won't do it. And they're saying quite rightly that Spain and Italy and a couple of other countries, mostly in Southern Europe, were in trouble before this ever happened. And they're simply not going to pay for it. They're not going to pay for the bailout. So, you know, these countries can't print their own currencies because they're part of the EU. So I think you're going to see abandonment of the euro. You'll see Spain going back to the peseta. You'll see Greece going back to the drachma. And you'll see Italy going back to the lira, because they can print it willy-nilly themselves and potentially get themselves out of the mess. All these places are democracies, of course, and they're only looking as far ahead as the next election, including America with Mr. Trump. So, you know, there's going to be situations where they're not really thinking about how they're going to get out of the mess maybe 5 or 6 years from now when the chickens come home to roost. It's really just getting through today and tomorrow and getting to the next election.
You know, Keith, both you and I have studied history, and the thing that really strikes me here, you alluded to it. I recently interviewed Professor Silla, who has updated Sidney Homer's book, The History of Interest Rates, And we have truly never seen anything like what we're seeing today in terms of negative interest rates in Europe, negative interest rates in Asia, and nearly zero interest rates here in the U.S. So that is something that's historical. And as you mentioned, we have never seen governments spend money like they are now. And I'm getting ready to write an article called Money for Nothing, because it's basically a situation, as you mentioned, municipalities are in trouble. I just looked at unemployment funds for three big states, California, New York, and Illinois, and they will be broke within the next 30 days as unemployment rises. So I can't imagine Congress or the president saying no to the states for unemployment when they're spending money to keep people employed. So whether it's municipalities, whether it's states like New York, which needs $4.5 billion to bridge their budget, whether it's companies, whether it's people that aren't working or furloughed, there's no end to the amount of money that is going to be issued. And of course, central banks will have the job of mopping it up. I want to turn our attention to another subject. You're in the exploration business. What is going to happen as the price of gold goes up? For so many years, a lot of the producers, Keith, weren't really making that much money. But at this level, where you have gold at $1,700, you've got silver, which is close to, what, $15.60. What about the earnings of gold producers?
Well, you know, over the last couple of years, a lot of the slop has gone out of the system. There was a situation 6-7 years ago where mining companies were gathering ounces under their name just for the sake of having ounces, but not really concerned about whether those ounces were going to be economic or even extractable. So a lot of the excess that was in the business 5, 6, 7 years ago is long gone, and the companies have emerged lean and mean. Now, we've got a situation here which is very, very interesting, Jim, and it's very important, I think, for your listeners to understand. First of all, if you're a production company outside the U.S., you get paid in U.S. dollars for your product. Let's say, for instance, that you're producing gold in Colombia in South America, and your costs are in pesos, and the peso right now is at a 5-year low against the U.S. dollar. So your costs in local currency are lower than they've ever been for a long, long time, but you're getting paid in U.S. dollars. So you're really cashing in there in a big way, especially when the gold and silver markets are moving up. Now, besides that, we have a fuel price right now, which is the lowest that it's been in many, many years. The major component cost of mining is gasoline and diesel, mostly diesel. And so you need diesel to run your trucks in an open pit operation, many, many different things, run the machinery and such. And so those costs have come down. So if you are a mining company that primarily have your assets outside the U.S., let's say they're in Canada and Australia, then you're coining money right now. You're doing very, very well. And in addition to all of this, well, we know that there have been a number of mining companies that have had to shutter their operations. A lot of them are starting to open up now. And I think really it's got to do with the fact that the governments of these countries where these projects reside realize that they need the revenue, and they need the revenue now. So they're loosening up the rules on them. But if you have a gold royalty company, you haven't faced any of the cost for shutdown. You haven't had to put anything on care and maintenance. A lot of these royalty companies, gold and silver royalties, only have maybe 20 employees, and they're all working from home. It's all business as usual for them, and they're in in the particular sweet spot right now.
So if you had to invest in the sector, you would be going with royalty companies and producers?
Absolutely, I would, yeah. And a small selection of exploration companies, because I think in this market that's coming, especially after Labor Day this year, you're going to see a lot of movement in the gold price. And anybody who makes a new discovery, I'd like to hope it's my company, but I don't know. I haven't got a crystal ball. But I think anyone is going to position themselves to do very well. I think the setup is more or less like after the tech wreck in 2001, 2002, when the gold market just started to move again. But I think we're going way past $1,900 in this case. I think we're headed way past 2,000. I have no idea where it's going to go, but I think it's going to be the go-to place for investors, especially investors who have invested in things like airline stocks, for instance. Look how badly they've been hit. Well, if you see gold companies like, I'll just mention Newmont and Barrick, they're the two biggest ones, you see them moving upward, then you know a lot of investors, especially retail people, are a little bit like people playing the roulette tables in Vegas. And they've lost all night, and they're going to try to make their money back. So I think you're going to see a large number of investors pour into a fairly small market. And that has got really, really big implications for the gold and silver equities and the gold price itself.
All right. Well, listen, Keith, as we close, if listeners would like to find out more about the company you run, would you mind giving out your website, please?
Well, the website is called Aurania.com. That's spelled Aurania.com.
Well, listen, Keith, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. Take care.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, back to The Big Picture. Today, we're going to discuss comeback, the road back to recovery with oil and the economy, also featuring in this discussion since there's a lot going on, not just in the economy, but also in the oil markets as well. Jim, let's talk about just how fast of a change we've seen, not just last week, but this week as well.
Yeah, I mean, this week, obviously, the big news story was what happened to the price of oil, where oil basically dropped by almost 300% in a single trading session on Monday. We'll get to that later on in the program, and we'll explain why that happened. But we're seeing things, Chris, probably in the last 2 months that we probably haven't seen in 100 years. You know, earlier in the broadcast, John Kosar is saying everything is happening so quick and changes so frequently now, whether it's sectors going up, sectors going down. And of course, everybody remembered how quickly this market fell. I mean, it's really hard to believe that 2 months ago, we were looking at a 3.5% unemployment rate, stock prices at record levels, economic growth. And then all of a sudden, within a 3 or 4 week period, the Dow loses almost 40%. And talk about what happened this week. You're talking about a 300% drop in oil in a single trading session. It just makes me wonder, Chris, because one of our guests that we have had on FS Insider is Gary Schilling. And about 3 years ago, we had Gary on the program, and he said interest rates were going below 1% and oil was below 10. And oh my goodness, the negative feedback we got, like, this guy's cuckoo. Well, he's looking pretty prescient as of this week. But, you know, I think the real question here now going forward, as we're talking about reopening the economy, what is that going to look like, which we'll be discussing today? Is it going to be a V-shaped recovery, which is what we've seen in the stock market? Is it going to be a U-shaped recovery? In other words, it'll be gradual and take place over time. Or is it going to be an L-shaped recovery, which is the worst case scenario, which is really a depression?
Yeah, and at this point, I think pretty much is a conclusion that the V-shaped recovery is not going to happen other than what we saw in the stock market, as you said, with the trillions of dollars that have been pumped in by the Fed and then on the U.S. government side. But at least on the economic side, as we've been discussing on our show, both on the weekend and on FS Insider, that it looks like the base case scenario now is more of a U or an L.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at what happened just in a period of 2 months, literally the government blew a hole through the economy. Chris, is probably as wide as the Grand Canyon. As of this Thursday, in which we're doing this big picture, I think it was 4.2 or 4.4 additional unemployment claims filed. 26 million Americans have filed for unemployment claims in just the last 5 weeks alone. And they're talking about the unemployment rate, which, remember, 2 months ago was at 3.5. They're talking by June, the unemployment rate could be 13% to 16%. And by the way, I mean, if we take a look at what's happened, the second wave of unemployment is now begun. The first wave was what you would expect: airlines, restaurants, malls, hotels, gyms, public events. Now businesses who have furloughed their workers or they're working from home, now businesses are starting to lay off workers as sales plummet as a result of the shutdown.
Yeah, as you noted, it's now working from tourism, hotel, hospitality, all those sectors to the white-collar economy now. And then, of course, like you said, we're looking at 16% unemployment rates. I think that's Morgan Stanley's estimate for what we'd see unemployment peak at in the second quarter. But that's a base case scenario if we don't see a second wave of infections and fatalities in the fall, which is, of course, the other scenario that everyone has in mind.
Yeah, because this is the base case. You have others like Fed Governor Bullard, Janet Yellen, that are talking about 20 to 30% unemployment. And during the Great Depression, the unemployment rate got to 24.9. But Chris, that was over 3 years, and a contraction of about 24% over 3 years. They're talking about if we go to the worst case scenario, where unemployment can rise to 20 and 30. But the reason more individuals, economists, investment firms are talking about the U-shaped recovery is because to fill the gap of this big hole that has been blown in the economy by the government, you've got stimulus like we've never seen before. And maybe that's what we ought to talk about next.
Yeah, for sure. Well, how much stimulus have we seen so far? I mean, we're definitely in the trillions, of course. How much more do you think is to come once all this is said and done?
Well, we got the first round one was $2.2 trillion. They quickly ran out of money. I just saw a news flash as we were doing the show, is that the Treasury is now asking those large corporations that got money from the stimulus, the payroll protection plan. Chris, here's an interesting statistic. 4% of the companies applying for the stimulus got 80% of the dollars that were in the program. So the Treasury is now going to large organizations like Ruth Chris and even some of the large colleges like Harvard, and they're saying, you know, give the money back. This was meant for small businesses, companies under 500 employees, not large organizations. But that was stimulus one. Working its way through Congress right now is stimulus two. And that's going to be an extension of the PPP, the Payroll Protection Plan, by roughly about $350 billion, including SBA loans. And that's going to be $480 to $500 billion. That's stimulus two. And while they're working its way through the House and reaching an agreement, they are already working on stimulus three. Now, stimulus three, as it's working its way through both houses, is going to include elimination of payroll taxes for employers and employees that could, you know, who knows how long this will last, to the end of the year or maybe even to next year. So as I wrote in the end of money, round one, $2.2 trillion, that was it, just round one. Round two is working its way through this week. Round three will be probably working its way by June. And I assume, Chris, if we get to the fall and the virus returns, we have outbreaks and possible shutdowns, you could be looking at stimulus four and five. I mean, there's no end to this because right now, we're talking about businesses, we're talking about people that are furloughed, that are unemployed, But also now you have states that are saying, hey, if you can bail out Boeing, you can bail out us. So states and municipalities could be in another round that could be stimulus 5, 6, or 7.
And if any of you haven't heard our interview with Bruce Melman, the Washington strategist this week on FS Insider, he made some important points that definitely bear noting. The government is really responding first to provide near-term stability. The second phase of all this is recovery. And then the third wave is going to be reform. So we should expect to see a lot of reforms come out of this, because this is, again, like you said, something that we haven't seen probably in U.S. history, when you even consider the speed of how fast the economy has cratered, and then also just the nature of the contraction itself. So there's going to be quite a learning experience out of this.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of this shutdown, which basically the World Bank says that global GDP will take between a $7 and $10 trillion hit when this is all done. So if you take a look at just what the government's going to do here in the U.S. and what the Fed's going to do, between the government stimulus spending program and the Fed, you're talking, Chris, just in the U.S. alone, $10 trillion in stimulus. And we're not even talking about Europe, which is even worse off, or even what's going on in Asia. But here's the point. You can't keep an economy on lockdown, or you put us into a depression we may not come back from. I mean, some governors I've heard talk, they want to shut down the economy to late summer, maybe the fall. You've got medical experts that are talking about shutting down the economy for the next 18 months. States now want stimulus funds, especially those that have been hit hard or they've mismanaged their economies. I mean, there's no endless amount of handouts from business to states and local governments to actually unemployed workers. But the longer you keep this economy shut down, the worse off it's going to be, the harder it's going to be to make a comeback and recover.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you can't expect to have a one-size-fits-all lockdown policy for every single state in the nation when, of course, each different region and state is having its own level of outbreaks. And they all have their own geographic profiles based on population density, culture. All those things are going to play a factor. So, I mean, when you think about it, we're going to have to allow a number of these different states and economies to come back online, commensurate with what we see taking place on the ground there.
Yeah, because, I mean, there were 8 or 9 states that did not shut down. They're doing fine. They weren't hit hard. And then you have even our own state of California, Chris, which these were statistics as of last week. But we have the largest population of about 40 million. And the total deaths as of last week was 971 in the state of California. And you would have expected much, much greater than that, or larger numbers of fatalities and infections. But that didn't take place.
Jim, let's talk about the impact that this is having on debt levels, right? I remember for many years we've been talking on our show about how the government has to keep interest rates low. We're now at the lowest interest rates we've seen in recorded history, as you discussed with Richard Cilla on our program last week. But I mean, what's happening with debt at this point?
The deficits are going to be much larger, and it's not just the spending, Chris. There was an article that was put out this week in the Wall Street Journal by the Social Security trustees. And they said that the safety net spending that is going up, that Social Security trustees say that the pay benefits will exceed income for Social Security in 2021 for the first time in 40 years. And if you think of what happens, social net spending goes up during a downturn because more people are unemployed, more Medicaid has to be spent. What also happens in a downturn is businesses shut down and they don't have sales. Well, tax revenues also go down, and that's going to lead to these monster deficits that they're talking about. And that is one of the things that we talked about, the second wave of unemployment. When you are not operating, you are not making sales, you don't have revenues coming in, that means your profits go down. That means more workers are laid off. That means the government collects less in taxes. So it's not just the fact that governments are going to be spending more money. It's also the fact they're going to be taking less in tax revenues. I mean, think of what they're spending right now. But also, Chris, think of what happens with Stimulus 3, which they're going to work on and hope to get out by the end of May and June, which is going to suspend all basically Social Security and Medicare taxes for the rest of the year for both employers and employees. So think of what that's going to do. And you also have this topic about, you know, for example, the big two programs, Medicare and Medicaid. Both of these programs run out of money by 2035, and they'll have to reduce benefits to 70% of what the benefits were. And you're seeing not just government stimulus, but you're also seeing the Fed intervene in ways I could have never imagined. In the last crisis, they began QE, QE1, 2, and 3. They were buying mortgages. They were buying debt. This time around, they're intervening in the corporate debt markets. They're buying investment-grade corporates, and they're also intervening in the junk bond market. I mean, so there's no end to this. And so that is why you have such disparate views. But I think there's a consensus that is starting to merge now that what happens when we come out of this is going to resemble a U-shaped recovery in the economy versus the V-shaped recovery you've seen in the stock market. And we'll get to the stock market just later on. But meanwhile, with this intervention, what you're doing is you're not allowing creative destruction in the markets to work. In many ways, the Fed is propping up a lot of zombie companies that shouldn't be basically alive because they're not profitable, they're not managed well, and they would not be sustained if they weren't able to be able to roll over their debt. And you're going to see this first for the balance of this year. The one sector that is going to get hit the hardest with this is the energy sector.
Well, Jim, let's talk about some of the probabilities between each of the alphanumeric-shaped recoveries. V, U, and L are the three different letters that we're looking at. What are some of the probabilities that we can attach to each of those letters?
You know, Chris, if we look at the three main ones, V, U, or L, there's probably a 25, 30% chance of a V-shaped recovery, and that's just based on a series of one massive stimulus after another. We're working, as I mentioned earlier, on a $500 billion stimulus number two. They're also working on stimulus number three, which could come out at the end of May and June. And who knows, we may get stimulus four and five. So if you keep pushing trillions and trillions of dollars into the economy, number one. Number two, the Fed backstops just about everything. And number three, you do not have a reoccurrence or shutdown in the fall when the next flu season begins. Well, maybe there's a possibility of a V-shaped recovery. But let's talk about the one more likely, which is U-shaped. And that tends to be somewhere around 50 to 55%. We're in a recession right now. Unemployment does not reverse quickly. And it may be to the end of 2021 that we actually come out of this. So that is the U-shape recovery and probability. The L-shape is somewhere between 15, 20%, and that's another wave of outbreaks, shutdowns, herd mentality takes over, people change their behavior. That's the depression scenario that doesn't end until a vaccine is available and people feel safe. So those are the three options and probabilities right now, with the greatest consensus and probability around a U-shape.
Jim, what happened to oil prices this week and last week? Because obviously this is causing a huge impact. And we think about the energy sector, as you said before. So what happened to oil prices?
Well, let's take a look at what happened on Monday. The price of oil dropped by almost $56 in a single day. They went below zero, roughly close to $40, a negative $40, a drop of 300%. So how did this happen? There are a number of factors that came into play, and one in particular. It was a combination of storage limitations. It was secondly, overproduction. Three, low prices. Four, leverage. And then fifth, which we're going to get into, is the difference between the paper oil markets and the physical markets. And one of the reasons you saw the drop on Monday, the largest owner of May WTI future contracts was a ETF called USO. They owned 25% of the May contracts. Now, the way that fund works is they roll over their contracts every single month. It's like a losing proposition because when the markets are in contango, that means future months, you have to pay more for those contracts. Well, USO is not in the business of taking delivery of their oil contracts. They just simply roll them over. And if we were in normal times, that's probably what happened. The problem is They couldn't roll that over. So, and plus, where are you going to take this oil? They're not in the storage business. So they basically had to dump all their May contracts to the point where they drove the price down below zero to negative. In other words, USO was paying traders to take delivery of their oil contracts. And so basically, as I mentioned, you know, most of this storage is being at Cushing. And we're going to talk about this because here's the problem that we have at Cushing. Basically, there's about 10 million barrels of oil storage left at Cushing. In other words, Cushing is at 85% storage capacity. And based on the current amount of oil that's coming into this country and still online being produced, by the middle of May, you could see Cushing full. So what you saw happen on Monday could happen to USO again, because they own 40% of the June contract, an even larger percentage of the July contract, and only 5% in August. And it's gotten so bad right now that, Chris, there are 80 super tankers out of the 750 worldwide that are now used for storage versus transport. There are 10 super tankers coming to the Gulf states from Saudi Arabia that we may turn around. And if it gets this bad, there are several proposals that they're talking about. The president is talking about open up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and allow companies to use that for storage. But right now, as a result of no place to put this, tanker rates are up 150 to 300%. Fracking is down 60% from the peak in April. Its production is down by 1 million barrels by the beginning of May. They're saying by the time we get to June, it's 2 million barrels will be done. And the problem was, it was this perfect storm of energy that we were talking about, the destruction of demand. I mean, if you have people sitting at home, they're not driving cars. If you got 75% of the airlines parked at an airport, they're not consuming jet fuel. So 40% of oil use comes from transportation. So you are not likely to see a recovery in the energy markets until the economy recovers. In other words, people start going back to work, they start driving again, and they start flying again. And so that's kind of how we saw this big drop that we saw on Monday, where you actually saw oil prices for the first time in history actually go below zero. You actually paid people to take your oil. And obviously, under those conditions, no oil company in the world, including the national oil companies, could operate under those kind of circumstances.
What sort of impacts do you think that this is going to have on the markets, Jim? Because, I mean, if you think about just the volatility of oil prices alone has a pretty severe impact. I mean, some of the correlations at different points throughout time have been as high as like 90%. So, you know, if oil's volatile, how is this going to translate to the markets?
Well, a couple things. In the energy patch, when we went through this oil downturn in 2014 to 2016, when oil dropped down to about $25, $26 a barrel, these shale companies were able to roll over their debt and get financing. So they were basically kept alive. That's not happening now. They're going under, they're going to file for bankruptcy, and the survivors are going to be the big boys who are going to end up gobbling up these companies. So if you're in oil, you better be with the majors. And so major bankruptcies are on the way and taking place. This is also going to be a setback for renewables because the cost of fossil fuels now are the cheapest they've ever been. So that's going to happen. But what does this mean for the markets? Let's take a look at what's happened in the markets. From dropping 38%, we've had this V-shaped recovery, which has been fast and furious, just as it was fast and furious on the way down. The market cannot keep up at this sustainable pace. So something's going to change there. There's also, secondly, a large gap between stock prices and where the economy is. And the economic restart will be gradual. And as you pointed out, Chris, it's going to be different for different states, different cities. So it's going to be more U-shaped than V-shaped. And the other thing that we have right now is almost the opposite of what we were seeing in March, is we've gone from extreme pessimism to now extreme optimism. It's sort of back to FOMO, the fear of missing out.
So, Jim, you've been pointing out for now several weeks here that it sounds like this is really going to be a seminal event that is going to alter not just America, but also the entire globe for years to come, just as much as we should expect from a war or the Great Depression.
You know, Chris, one of the things that's going to happen is a lot of trends that were in place before this happened are just going to be accelerating. I don't care if it's reshoring. They're talking about a stimulus package that they're going to go to companies and say, if you relocate your factory from China back to the U.S., which we really seriously need to do when it comes to drugs and vaccines, we're going to let you write that off. So look for a stimulus bill coming in that direction. The other thing that's going to happen is many universities have shut down and a lot of students are attending online. Education, I expect a lot of universities are going to go under the incredible amount of student debt that's out there. You're going to have a lot of parents that are going to start asking questions. Do I really want to spend $38,000, $40,000 a year to have my kids take classes online? I think you're going to see a lot of private universities and tech companies work with these private universities to compete with brick and mortar universities, just as the online sellers like Amazon are competing with brick and mortar. So a lot of education institutions are going to go by the wayside. We've already talked about retailing. I think buying from home, staying at home is going to be more prevalent. Savings are going to go up. You can't go through something like this without being impacted by it. So a lot of the institutions, you've got Neiman Marcus, filing for bankruptcy, and I see a lot more of those major department stores from JCPenney's and others following suit. I think network TV is going to be gone in the next 3 to 5 years. We had a gentleman that wrote the book called Four. He's a professor in marketing, Scott Galloway. And Chris, you know, maybe we want to play that clip.
COVID-19 isn't as much something that's going to change everything as much as it will accelerate it. And there's a basic truth that we've been ignoring for a long time. And I say this as someone who's made a nice living preaching the principles of brand strategy. And that is advertising sucks and people want to avoid it. Don Draper has been drawn and quartered. The heyday of Mad Men and advertising, those days are over. Advertising is going, and ad-supported companies are going to come out of this much, much weaker, unless they have the scale of a Facebook or a Google that will emerge from this even stronger.
How many people want to watch a regular TV show or an evening news? For example, what are you going to learn in network news at night in a half-hour broadcast of which 9 minutes will be commercials that you haven't already heard from some news feed on your smartphone throughout the day? So, and who wants to watch a television program where, you know, every 12 minutes you get interrupted for 3 or 4 minutes worth of commercials? So hence, you know, you take a look at one of the big winners of this, Netflix, 16 million new subscribers, Amazon Prime, Hulu, more of that. And so I think the networks are dinosaurs. And along with the news media, the travel industry, I think that's going to be more local. Restaurants are going to be different. They're going to have to come up with, just as the survivors in retail like Walmart, Target, Costco have gone to an online presence on store pickup, restaurants are going to have to kind of adapt with more takeouts is going to be a thing. The other thing that you're going to see, you're already seeing now, everybody's using Zoom. Google is announcing a competitor to Zoom. Technological advances are going to keep coming. So you're going to see telemedicine. You're going to see teleconferences. And like I said, one of the questions is going to be, you know, right now is, do we really need to have this online? The question in the future is, do we really need to meet in person? Think of how much money businesses save if you don't have to put your staff on a plane. So you have air travel, you have hotels, the cost of meals, the cost of the convention, when you can simply do this online. So all of this is simply going to accelerate coming out of this. And the great thing about the American economy being a private sector economy is some smart entrepreneur is going to pick up on this and they will be successful. So we're going to have winners and we're going to have losers and what we call creative destruction, which is basically the behavior of a capitalistic society.
You know, Jim, one of the big things that's being discussed, and obviously you see this with the protests that are taking place currently, but, you know, just the backlash that we're seeing from people, that, you know, especially in areas that are not getting hit hard, which I fully understand, you know, like you and I were talking about with San Diego, you know, it's very low in terms of the infection rate and the number of people that have actually died relative to the entire population. And so obviously the response needs to be proportional to what's happening in each area. And that's what we've discussed so many times. And that's really what's the national conversation right now and that the protests are about. But with that, there is this fear that we're seeing this tremendous overreach by governments. Do you see government's power going well beyond what it should be in this crisis?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're trampling the Constitution in individual liberties. And Chris, there's an inconsistency in these policies. I mean, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, but one governor going to Lowe's and Home Depot and say, you can't sell paint, flooring, you got to close your garden shop, going to grocery stores, you can't sell seeds. Here in Los Angeles, we're in New York, we're turning people into snitches. Los Angeles let out 25% of their prisoners out of jail, and we're arresting people for walking on beaches. A lot of this stuff has no consistency or science behind this. The other thing is a tremendous loss of credibility of the media. I mean, if you watch some of these press conferences, the economic questions, I mean, the illiteracy in the media, I've never seen more dumb or stupid questions that are raised in some of these conferences. It's like, you know, do your homework if you're going to ask some questions. But I think that a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of stuff that's happening here that has nothing to do with the virus itself. Same thing with the way we're spending money in some of these stimulus packages. There's stuff that's put in there for every single congressman, pork projects, all kinds of things that have nothing to do with this virus. And so this is an overreach and overstepping in a lot of individual liberties. I mean, you know, arresting somebody for playing softball with his daughter in a park with nobody else around. I mean, just a lot of this stuff, Chris, simply doesn't add up or make sense or can be justified. And that's why I think you're seeing these protests erupt. And I think you had a guest recently on your program, Martin Armstrong, that's talking about he sees an increase of those protests coming, if I'm correct.
Yeah, Martin Armstrong was predicting an uptick in societal protests and revolutions prior to the 2020 election. And that's something that he was predicting even last year, well before any of the coronavirus. So a global pandemic wasn't in his forecast, of course, but a lot of what he said is now coming true.
Yeah. And I think, Chris, what this is really leading to is the end game with the financial system that's ultimately going to lead to debt forbearance and devaluation of the dollar. You know, it was done during the Great Depression with Franklin Roosevelt. He devalued the dollar by almost 70%. It was done once again in August of 1971 with Nixon when he took gold backing off the dollar. Basically, there was gold backing for central banks. So if you were a central bank and you were owning dollars, you could tender those dollars and you could get gold. Well, Nixon ended gold backing of the dollar to free-floating exchange rates in August of 71. And it's like anything else, wars and revolutions change society, government, and empires. And I think the tech revolution is going to accelerate as our knowledge base increases. So I don't see any of that stopping. But eventually, I do see a major devaluation coming, Chris. And that's one reason why that it's been in the interest of the government to see interest rates fall, which they've been doing steadily since August of 1981, to where they are today, where in many places of the world, they're negative or at zero, because who benefits? The main beneficiary of that is government when you are racking up trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. I mean, George W. Bush doubled the debt from 5 to 10 trillion. Obama doubled it from 10 to 20 trillion. And I thought maybe, if Trump got elected, he may double the deficit by 50%. But Chris, at the rate we're going right now, he may end up doubling it if he gets a second term. And that's why I think the ultimate outcome of all of this is devaluation. I believe so strongly in this that I'm starting another series that I'm calling The End of Money. I've already written my first piece, and I'm going to be writing two or three more. I've been doing a lot of research on depressions, recessions, devaluations throughout history and putting it together. But that's the direction we're heading in. I'm going to be writing about it in a number of upcoming pieces I'm going to be writing in a series. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Until you and I talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
As always, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense NewsHour and the wide range of topics that we discuss, both on our free weekend program as well as our premium weekday FS Insider podcast, where we interview a wide range of different guests, investment strategists, and book authors from around the globe. If you'd like any more information about our investment services or to speak with us about our outlook, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us, or you can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.